Welcome back to the DFS Office Hours Podcast. I'm your host, Jordan, and this episode is a recording of an interview I conducted with SaberSim founder Matt Hunter, streamed live on the SaberSim YouTube channel on March 31st, 2022. I asked Matt about his history and expertise with MLB DFS, learned the high-level strategies needed to be successful in the sport, and also discussed some of the unique edges that we think will be exploitable in the 2022 season. You can expect to see more of these strategy-focused interviews at the start of new sports seasons, and I hope you enjoy. What is going on, everybody? Baseball season is back, and to get ready for the start of the MLB DFS season, I wanted to bring Matt on to talk about his experience and history and success playing daily fantasy baseball. We'll get into the overall philosophy and the high-level strategy needed to be successful, talk about what's new for this season, and provide an overview of what a winning baseball DFS process looks like. We've got a lot to talk about here on today's stream, so I want to jump into things quickly. But first, before we get started, just wanted to do a quick reminder for everybody that we do these shows live for a reason. So if you have questions for me or for Matt, post them into the Office Hours channel in Slack or into YouTube chat. We'll do our best to get through all of the questions before the end of the show. But let's go ahead and jump right into it here. First of all, welcome back, Matt.
Thanks, Jordan.
Glad to be back. Yeah, cool. So let's go ahead and jump in. I just wanted to talk a little bit about your background playing baseball DFS first. So when did you first start getting into the sport?
So I got into it probably starting in 2015, maybe. You know, it's basically when I was getting started with SaberSim. Mm-hmm. I first started SaberSim sort of as a research tool for kind of sabermetrics baseball research. And in doing so, I kind of like learned about daily fantasy and started playing, you know, as I was building out SaberSim. And so, it was like 2015, just DraftKings to start. And, you know, it was a weird time, I think, for DFS. Mm-hmm. I think I was mostly just playing like single lineups or maybe like five lineups at a time. And, you know, didn't really know about any of like the fundamentals of playing. I would just sort of like play the top projections and, you know, but it was successful at the beginning because no one really knew what they were doing. So, yeah.
So you kind of built out the sabermetric tool first and then discovered DFS almost more as an application to potentially use that. Am I understanding that correctly?
Yeah. Like I wanted to build a baseball sim because I was interested in, baseball stats and like I was writing articles for like Fangraphs and Hardball mm-hmm. Times and stuff. And just sort of as a personal, like, hobby project, I wanted to write a baseball sim. After writing it, I kind of realized, oh, this could be, I could sim the games for every day. Mm-hmm. And then I could use the results of those sims to like create projections for the players and then, you know, use those for daily fantasy. So yeah, it was really, you know, I had built the sim and the tools before even learning about DFS and then realized, oh yeah, what I've built could actually be applied here.
Gotcha. Cool. Yeah. So 5-6 years almost of history playing the sport here. Do you have any particular memorable wins that you've pulled down in that time that stand out in particular?
I mean, I've had definitely a few throughout the year throughout the years. I think like it was some like Wednesday, like early slate. So for baseball, like there's generally like Monday and Tuesday and Friday are mm-hmm. like all the games are at night. And then Wednesday and Thursday we'll have day slates. And I remember it was some random like early slate on Wednesday was my first like five figure win. I think it was like 10 or 15K. But I was a pretty small time player. And so that was just like huge to I can't even remember who the key player was that like won. You'd think I'd remember because that was like my first big win. But yeah, that was like the first one. But I had a few decent, I feel like actually those kind of mid-sized like day slates have been the most successful for me for whatever reason. They're also fun because I don't know, it's like during the day, you can just like watch baseball at work. I mean, don't tell Andy, but that's
what if it goes bad, then you've got the main slate coming around in like an hour anyway.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So yeah, those are fun, but you know, when they first added Showdown too, I had a lot of fun playing that, especially they had different relief pitcher scoring when they first added Showdown on DraftKings, and there was so much edge because they would have like way inflated points for like relief pitcher strikeouts and saves and stuff, and so you could get a bunch of edge just by like slamming like captain relief pitchers, and there's not as much of that anymore, but yeah, I had a lot of success with the Showdown slates at the beginning, and a bit last year too, actually, just because there's a lot of variation compared to like NFL and NBA Showdowns. MLB, there's just way more possible lineups, and so you can get unique pretty easily. So yeah, that's
gotcha. Cool. Yeah, no, I'm happy to hear that. I definitely want to talk a little bit more about the Showdown strategy and just some of those alternative contest types as we move along here. You know, before we, I guess, kind of get into some of those strategy things for people that maybe have been playing NBA all season, heading into their first baseball season, what would you say the baseball sweat is like if you're, you know, sweating out a potential win? I know I had Dan Kingfish Nato here on for NASCAR, and he basically just said, if you open your lineups before the final lap, you're a masochist. But what's the baseball sweat?
Yeah. I mean, baseball sweats are fun because it's, you're really relying on like home runs. Not necessarily, you don't need that, but you know, a home run, a solo home run is 14 points. A grand slam is 20 points for on DraftKings.
Yeah.
And so you can get pretty big swings with, you know, a swing of a bat,
right?
Unlike something like NBA, obviously, you know, a player can go on a run, but it's a slower, like you're kind of slowly rising up the standings, whereas for MLB, you might have a big inning and go from like not cashing to like top 10 just because like a bunch of your players hit home runs. So it's actually, I think it's a fun sweat. I mean, it can be brutal if like you have 90% ownership of a pitcher and they get rocked in the first inning. So obviously, you know, but that's sort of just DFS, but I think it's a fun sweat, especially because, and we'll kind of go over this later, but you know, I think it's good to have pretty spread out exposures to your stacks, to the teams that you're playing. And so you often have like a few different options for, you know, lineups to sweat. So even if like your top owned stack doesn't score many runs, you might have a few lineups that are still in play by the end of the night. So there's usually like something to sweat. You can at least be like, all right, this lineup, if they score, you know, 15 runs in the late game, I have a chance. So,
which happens so often, like you can get. Cool. So let's go ahead and start talking about, you know, overall higher level strategy. So I realize this is kind of a big question here, but I just want to kick this one over to you and just start here. What do you feel like is the fundamental biggest edge in baseball DFS?
Oh, that's it's a tough question because I think it has changed a lot over the years. I mean, for people that are just getting into MLB DFS, the biggest thing is stacking. So, you know, because correlation is so important. So for when you're entering these big GPPs, you know, you want to get a top 1%, top 0.1% lineup. In MLB, getting the correlations between your players so that you can kind of hit that top 1% outcome is really important. And so you do that through stacking, which is just, you know, a group of batters from the same team all in your lineup. It's a little bit different than some other sports where the correlation between like individual players isn't actually that high, but when you get the group of four or five players on the same team, it is just way higher. And the main reason for that is actually, you might think it's like runs and RBIs where, you know, you get a player, they get a hit and drive someone in, you know, the player that scores gets a run and the player that gets the hit gets an RBI. So that's kind of points for both. And that's the correlation there. But I think the biggest impact for getting that like really top 1% outcome is that anytime a player gets a hit, that's an additional plate appearance that the lineup as a whole gets. And so if you kind of stack hit on hit on hit, then like everybody on the team is getting more plate appearances. And when you think about the fact that like the average, you know, opportunities that a player might get is four, you know, a batter might get four plate appearances on average per game. If their team does really well, they might get five or six. And so that's like increasing just their playing time. It's as if like in NBA, it's like going from 30 minutes to 40 minutes or more just because of like how your team does. And that's obviously like a huge increase. And so getting like six plate appearances is just so much more. You're just really increasing both the floor and the ceiling. And so when you have all of your the players on the team just like, you know, getting on base, there's more runs to drive in and there's just more opportunities for fantasy points. So that's really like the big thing is you essentially want to make stacks of four or five, you know, on FanDuel, four is the max, DraftKings five is the max. And you basically want that stack to score, you know, 8 to 10 plus runs, because usually on a big slate, there'll be at least one team that's going to score 10 plus runs. Just, that's just kind of how randomness works. And so you just kind of, you want to make sure that you get that team basically.
Right.
Obviously it's more nuanced than that, but that's kind of the idea is that you want that team that's scoring 10 plus runs a night, especially if they're coming from home runs, because that's like the biggest way to get fantasy points.
Right. Gotcha. And I mean, I think we'll talk a little bit more about kind of process specifics here, but I think this is a good opportunity to pull up Jacob's question here while we're talking about correlation. I mean, would you say that broadly speaking, a general stacking strategy would be to build the biggest stacks you can make on a on each site? Because I know each site does a little bit different rules with that.
Yeah. Yeah. So for DraftKings, you can do 5-3. For FanDuel, you can do 4-4. I guess I would say that doing, you know, 5-3 or 4-4 stacks is never going to be bad. Like you are going to have high quality lineups. If you force 5-3 in your DraftKings lineups and do 155-3 stacks, like it's kind of hard to go wrong there. That said, you know, you might be limiting your really like maximum ceiling upside a little bit if you're forcing all stacks, because you're kind of saying, if you have players that, you know, if there's a player that hits two home runs, the rest of their team does nothing, which is very possible, happens pretty frequently. You know, you're not going to have that player, and that's okay, because in baseball, you don't need to have the highest possible scoring lineup. You just want to have the highest lineup in the field.
Right.
And there's billions or trillions of different lineup combinations, and there's only, you know, 50,000 entries in the contest. So you don't need the maximum possible score. That said, I think, you know, when you're forcing those stacks, one, you get a little bit less flexibility in the players that you're playing. If there's a really good home run hitting player on a bad team, then you're going to have much less of them in your stacks, because it's like the team is low likelihood to score a bunch of runs, even if that player is likely to do well. But, you know, I think for beginners, and especially for people that are playing low stakes, kind of softer contests, I think forcing stacks is like a pretty safe approach that's going to give you, like, on average, I think you're going to have pretty high quality lineups, and there's less risk of like you, if you just force a five stack and then you have like three one-off players going with them, there's a little bit more risk in like kind of just getting bad one-offs, or like they don't do well. And so you're just kind of, even if your stack does well, you're not going to get that top 10 result. Whereas if you have the 5-3, it's like, you know, all you're basically hoping for is that both of those stacks do well. So yeah, long story short, I think it's reasonable to use those stacks. For me personally, I usually will want like one big stack in all of my lineups, and then I kind of let the secondary stack come naturally. So I will have some 5-3, I'll have some 5-2-1, I'll have some 5-1-1-1 on DraftKings or FanDuel. I'll have like, I think 4-3 is kind of a common stack in FanDuel. So like you'll have four players on one team, three on another, and then one off player. On FanDuel, you can, just to clarify, actually on both sites, you can stack your pitcher with that stack. On FanDuel, you didn't used to be able to do that. So there'd be value in doing like a 4-3-1 so that you could stack your pitcher, but you can stack a pitcher, I believe, unless they changed it, with your stack. So, and that's a little bit of correlation there, because if your stack does well, the pitcher is likely to get a win, which is not that many points, but it's something. So,
gotcha. Cool. You had mentioned right when we started this question here, the first thing you said is that you feel like the edge has changed over time. I'm interested to hear what you were going to say about that before we jumped into the correlation
thing. Yeah. So I think partly it's just the field has caught on to stacking being a good idea. Probably in 2015 when I started, I wasn't stacking because I never played before, I hadn't really thought about the correlation aspect of it. Mm-hmm. A lot of people were not stacking, and so you probably got decent edge just by stacking because nobody else was.
Right.
Now, again, it depends on the contest you're playing. In softer contests, there's probably going to be a bit less stacking, and so you might have more edge there. And like the big GPPs, you're going to probably, I haven't looked at the numbers, but it's probably like 90% of the lineups have decent sized stacks. I could be wrong. I honestly haven't looked at like exactly what the field is doing. So, you know, if everybody's stacking, there's not really much edge to be gained from that. And from a game theory perspective, if literally say every single lineup in the contest has a five stack, you actually probably have edge from stacking a little bit less because mm-hmm. say, you know, it's a 8-game slate and say none of the teams really have like a five stack that goes off. Maybe some teams score like 8 runs, but like it's only 3 or 4 players that do well. Like you actually might have some edge in doing a 4-4 stack or even doing like 3-3 and a few one-offs. So I think having a little bit of flexibility with how you're stacking just based on like what the field is doing, mm-hmm. Especially I'd say like on smaller slates where you need to get closer to the true optimal score on a small slate in order to win, you probably want to do less forcing of the stacks and smaller stacks, because if the field is all forcing these big stacks and there's a decent chance that that's not going to be, you know, a optimal winning lineup, then you might want to force less of it. So that's basically what I mean by strategy has changed, is that
yeah,
as everybody else that's playing DFS gets smarter and, or at least gets, has more understanding of like the good strategies, mm-hmm. then you kind of want to think about, okay, from a game theory perspective, if everyone is doing this, can I get edge by changing that approach?
Right.
And so just to expand on that a little bit, I think one thing that one way you can get edge is having a more organic stacking approach, mm-hmm. Where you're not necessarily saying, I think a lot of people will say, okay, I want the like 2 through 6 or 2 through 5 batters in the lineup. And you want to have like all of your, like the batting orders kind of all be sequential, which mm-hmm. makes logical sense because again, like I was saying before with runs and RBIs, you know, if they're all sequential, then those runs and RBI points are going to stack up. But I think from a real upside perspective, the correlation upside that comes from stacking is more about the plate appearances. And so if you do like a, you know, you might play like the leadoff hitter and then like 3, 4, 6, 8 or something, which is kind of a weird stack that most people might not do, but you can still get that upside from the extra plate appearances that all the players get. There's still decent correlation between those players, and you're kind of differentiating from the like typical stack that people would play.
Well, and you made a really good point too when we got started here, that the correlations between these players are more about every player getting more plate appearances rather than the RBIs and the players on base when somebody
knocks
a run in or something. That would kind of speak to that too, that maybe the field is undervaluing how correlated the 3rd and the 8th hitter in the order actually are.
Exactly. Yeah. And a lot of that is sort of this upside correlation where it's not like the average correlation might be higher between the 3 and 4 hitters, because like say in a game where the team scores 4 or 5 runs, there might be more correlation in that runs and RBIs, but like that mm-hmm. 99th percentile correlation where you're trying to get lineups that are scoring 200 plus points in on DraftKings or whatever, that's coming more from those extra plate appearances, and, you know, more opportunities to like hit home runs basically, you know?
Gotcha. Cool. Yeah. And Neil makes a good point here too, talking about slate dependence and slate size.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Probably, I think you mentioned it as well, on a smaller slate when people are going to approach that optimal, we want to be a little bit more cautious, I guess, with just blind rules here, but
yeah, absolutely.
Cool. So, I mean, thinking back, you know, to the ages of when people weren't stacking as much, 2016, 2017 baseball DFS, I think you could, you know, have this idea that, you know, stacking is an edge and there people aren't doing this. Do you have a sense of maybe anything that might be like that in 2022 here? Something that, you know, with your experience, it maybe kind of feels like people aren't really thinking about enough that maybe might present a little bit more of kind of a hidden edge or a hidden angle for baseball DFS this season?
That's a good question. I mean, I think, like I said about the sort of organic stacking, I think being flexible with the types of stacks that you are generating is really valuable.
Yeah.
So rather than just forcing one stack type, in the same way that you want to like spread out your exposures to the different to different players and different teams, because you don't know kind of what's going to happen on the slate, and there's you want to give yourself the opportunity to win among a bunch of different possible outcomes. It's the same thing for that stacking, where rather than just setting specific rules for like, I want these types of stacks, if you can get more organic with it and have just like a exposure to different stacking types that somewhat mimics the probability of those stack types being the bank lineups, then that's going to give you a decent amount of edge and kind of a good good diversification of your lineups, where it's like, yeah, maybe most of my lineups have five stacks, but maybe some of them are like 3-3-2, where you know you have more of those mini stacks. And I think that's kind of an edge in, it's not necessarily like one specific type of stack that's an edge that the field isn't considering, but it's looking at your portfolio of lineups, looking at like, okay, this is what I'm playing with, and I want to have a nice mix of different stack types based on like how likely they are to, you know, be that top 1% lineup. Just trying to think if there's anything else that jumps out in terms of like something the field might be not be accounting for. I mean, I think like what I said before with the batting order, I think including low batting order players in your stacks is an edge that, you know, a lot of the field might just be saying, okay, give me a stacks, but only do spot six and above.
Right.
I think including those 8-9 hitters, and even doing like a kind of a wraparound stack where it's like you have 8-9-1-2. I know I said like they don't necessarily need to be next to each other in lineup, but I think some people might, if you do want that correlation from the runs and RBIs, then doing one of those wraparound stacks can be helpful, because obviously like the one hitter goes right after the nine hitter, but someone setting a rule that they only want 1-6 aren't going to get those players at all.
Right.
And, you know, they're often good value. And so you just get that upside game where the nine hitter, you know, gets a few hits and a stolen base and some runs, and, you know, that correlates with the 1-2 hitter. You know, that's a good way to differentiate, where maybe it's even like a really chalky stack where someone, you know, a team playing in Coors, their implied total is like 7 runs, but the 8-9 hitters are at only 5% owned. You're kind of being able to take advantage of that like high Vegas total and still play the chalky stack that's high scoring, but getting a bit of that game theory low ownership as part of it.
So since you mentioned chalk and thinking about ownership, how do you in general navigate ownership in baseball? How do you think about the chalk in general?
Yeah, it's a good question, because I think that ownership is more important in baseball than maybe any other DFS sport other than like maybe hockey, because it's such a high variance sport. And you know what I mean is just it's harder to predict. The results are more random, because each player, each batter is only getting 4 or 5 opportunities. And so there's just a ton of variance, and even the best player on the slate is going to have a very high probability of like scoring 0 points.
Right.
And so there's a lot of edge in MLB just from making smart ownership game theory decisions. And so what I mean by that is, you know, if a player is, or if a stack is 30% owned in a big contest, that's the implication there is that the stack is 30% likely to be like the winning, you know, in the winning lineup, in the bank lineup. And for like an 11 game slate, say, or a 15, you know, some of these slates are in MLB are 15 games.
Yeah.
And so that's 30 different teams. And the likelihood of one team out of 30 being the top scoring is almost never going to be 30% or even 20%. It's going to be pretty low. But because most people are just kind of using average projections with an optimizer, they might get way more of those stacks than is optimal. And I don't want to say that it's always a good idea to fade like the chalkiest stack, because sometimes they're just a good play. And even if there's edge in being underweight on them, fading them completely is just going to you know, you have the chance of just completely blanking a slate, and that's never fun. But I think there's a lot of edge in making good ownership decisions in when you're kind of dialing in your exposures to different team stacks, of looking like at the projected ownership of your players, and even if you still have exposure to those chalky stacks, of having a little bit less of them, because you know that there's always a pretty high probability, a relatively high probability of a player or a stack disappointing. And so it's very different than something like NBA in that regard, where a, you know, starting 3K player that's going to get 35 minutes has a very tiny, tiny probability of like, of not doing well. Whereas in baseball, there's always a probability of a higher probability than like in NBA of a player, you know, being below their expectation, below what's needed to win. So yeah, you really want to take advantage of, you know, that probability compared to their ownership.
Gotcha. Yeah. And I mean, we'll probably talk about this in a little more detail tomorrow when we dive deeper into the model and the sims, but you can see it visually on the app pretty often. The most common outcome for almost any hitter playing baseball that day is zero, no matter how good their average projection is.
Yep. Yep. That's like almost always the mode, like the most common. Yeah. The most likely outcome is always like zero, maybe two, if it's like someone that walks a lot or something,
right.
But like, yeah, if you like look at the you sort by like 25th percentile, it's all for batters, it's always like, you know, 0 to 3 or something. It's like right. that's a pretty high likelihood scenario.
So missing, I mean, a little bit of slate context obviously here, but yep. I think broadly speaking, Coors games maybe a little more on the side of fading rather than playing them when you've got the 30% owned Coors stacks.
Yeah, Coors is always, it's always tough. I mean, I've been doing this for, you know, like 6 or 7 years, and it's like anytime there's a Coors game, they're always coming up pretty high in your exposures. And that's just because they're just always like the highest scoring, the highest implied total, like for Vegas or for like the Sabre Sim projections, they're almost always the highest total game on the slate. And so it often is a pretty tough decision. I think one way that you can get some ownership edge is, one, playing Coors when there's a good pitcher in mm-hmm. Coors. So if it's Max Scherzer pitching in Coors, mm-hmm. He very well might, you know, good pitchers are good pitchers. And so, yeah, he might do really well. But I think especially since what you're looking at the upside, you're looking for the 99th percentile outcome. Mm-hmm. If Max Scherzer gets rocked in Coors in the first 4 innings, and then they bring in the bullpen, which is going to be much worse, mm-hmm. then you have another 6 innings of basically a normal Coors, or maybe even below average pitchers in right. Coors. And so I think you can get edge by stacking Coors when it's good pitchers. But yeah, like for, you know, when it's like bad pitchers in Coors and it's like a 7.5 total, yeah, it might be a good idea to be underweight on them. I think it's hard to say like fade entirely unless you're really comfortable with your bankroll management and you're fine like just losing it all when they yeah. end up scoring 15 runs. But yeah, again, I mean, even if the implied total of the game of the team is 7 runs, or if the projected total is 7 runs, there's a really high likelihood that they're going to score 2 to 3 to 4 runs. Mm-hmm. You know, there's outcomes where they score 15 and there's outcomes on the other side. And so just looking at 7 runs as the implied total and saying, oh, that's 2 runs higher than any other team, that doesn't mean that they're going to be 2 runs higher than every other team. There's still like a lot of situations where, you know, those teams don't score well. And so you kind of just want to think about, you know, look at the distribution graphs if you're using SaberSim, or just like think about what's the probability of these teams not doing well, what's their ownership, and just make those decisions based on that.
And on the subject of pitchers, I guess, like, what are your thoughts on ownership and chalky pitchers overall? Because I know that the distributions and the ranges of outcomes for pitchers are going to be a little bit different than what it looks like for hitters and stacks. How do you navigate pitching chalk?
Yeah, so pitchers are different than batters. And yeah, I haven't really touched on pitchers yet. So obviously, like I said, with batters, they generally have 4 to 6 opportunities to score points. Pitchers have, 25 to 30 batters faced usually in a game. So probably maybe a little bit less, but, they have a lot more opportunities. So there's less variance for sure in pitching. And so just based on that, you want to be less, more willing to have high exposure to pitchers, especially like really good pitchers, than with batters. That doesn't mean that there's no chance that they do badly. There's obviously, even with the best pitchers, there can be a high likelihood that they do badly. But for pitchers, the most important thing is strikeouts. Just in terms of, honestly, that affects the pitcher's floor more than anything. A lot of people kind of think of strikeouts as like, this is the upside, but
yeah.
With a high strikeout pitcher, you can give up 5 runs. And if you get 12 strikeouts, then you have a good day. And so like because high strikeout pitchers are much less reliant on shutting down the other team in terms of runs scored than a pitcher that's more of like a pitched contact person, where like if they, only get 5 strikeouts in the game, they really need to hold the other team to like 0, 1, 2 runs to have a decent fantasy point output. And run scoring is just higher variance than strikeouts. It's in terms of like, there's a good article actually on FanGraphs that I reference all the time. That's like the sample size needed for pitching or for all these different statistics to stabilize. And strikeouts is like 70 batters face. It's like a few starts for like the strikeout rate of a pitcher to sort of be like stable in terms of you can look at it and be like, oh, that's representative of their true talent. And so that kind of tells you, and for something like, hits or like a BABIP, so like hits per batted ball, it's like an entire season of data is what you need. And so that just tells you how high variance kind of batted ball outcomes are compared to strikeouts. And so that is all to say that a high strikeout pitcher has a very high floor because their strikeouts are much less random. And so, but in terms of like really, when you're looking at like upside compared to mean, so like if you're looking at the average projections and then comparing it to the 99th percentile, the highest gaps between those two are actually like high home run pitchers, because home runs are like the highest variance stat. And so a like okay pitcher that's in a really high home run park is actually can be like a good target for a low owned play, because they might have really low floor, because if they give up 3 home runs, then they're done.
Yeah.
But if they don't give up any home runs, then they've got the opportunity to have a really high ceiling outcome. And so that's kind of one thing that I think is a bit underappreciated in DFS. People really look at strikeouts for pitchers, which is really important for floor and important for exposure. If you're looking at like, okay, if I have 90% ownership of a high strikeout pitcher, that's a lot safer than 90% ownership of a pitch to contact pitcher, because they're more likely to less likely to fail completely. But when you're looking for low owned like sneak plays, I think looking at pitchers that still might have strikeout upside but are in a higher scoring park facing a high home run team, stuff like that, there's just going to be a lot more variance, and more variance generally means like there's kind of more upside relative to their ownership. So sorry, that I feel like I kind of rambled a lot there, that's sort of my approach for pitching. From a practical standpoint, in terms of like your exposures, I think it really depends on the slate. I think when it comes to guys like DeGrom and Max Scherzer and like the top tier pitchers, you don't be afraid to go really heavy on those guys. Obviously they can be really high owned, but like if you've got, I think opening day is DeGrom against the Nationals, who are a pretty weak hitting team now. He's just going to be a really, really high floor play. There's still value, I think, in not going 100%, because if he hits, even if he hits like his 50th percentile, it's going to be high scoring, but he's really expensive. And then that makes it hard to play an expensive stack. So like the salaries always come into play, but going super heavy on him is not going to be a bad idea. He'll very likely score highly, and you'll have the opportunity to win if you have 100% of him, So I wouldn't be too afraid to go heavy on pitchers like that, but pitchers that are worse, that might not last as long in the game, that might give up home runs, you know, I think you could spread out exposure more for them.
Gotcha. Cool. Yeah. I want to dive a little bit further deep into like actually what your day-to-day process kind of looks like capturing all of this, this information here. I mean, first things first, when does the baseball DFS process start? I know in basketball season, a lot of times on office hours, I'm telling people if they start a half hour before lock, it might be 20 minutes too early. What is the, when does the baseball DFS process start?
Yeah. So the most important thing is starting lineups. So for, unlike basketball, in baseball, the starting nine are generally like the only players that you want to play. So those are generally released 2 to 3 hours before the game starts.
Actually more like
three, because generally like the West Coast games that are starting at 10 Eastern, their lineups are going to be released between 6:30 and 7 Eastern, so like right before lock. So very often you'll get those late, like the Giants or the Dodgers, that might release their lineup after lock, which is always kind of annoying. But that doesn't mean that you have to wait to build your lineups. First of all, starting lineups are much more predictable in MLB. So especially at the beginning of the season, it'll probably be like for opening day, it'll be pretty predictable. Unless there's like injuries and kind of those questionable situations, you'll know who most of the players are that are going to be in the lineup. There obviously can be changes, but you can build pretty early. Pitchers are likely not going to change, but generally, like for myself, I'll start building, like you said, probably 30 minutes before, because basically once I have like all of the East Coast and Central time lineups, and like ideally most of the West Coast ones, I'll want to build, but you want to definitely get like your, you want to build a few times so that you can at least get good lineups in. If the Dodgers lineup comes out 5 minutes before lock, like then it's kind of a decision of like, okay, do I want to like redo my build for this, or do I want to just make adjustments after lock for the players that might be missing? So that's just kind of a judgment call based on how much work you did on your build. If you have time to really, with 5 minutes, if you have time to redo your entire thing, or if you want to just say like the value I put in to my lineups is higher than whatever value I'm going to get from like replacing this nine hole batter on the Dodgers with this other one. But yeah, so definitely it's not like NBA. There still can be late scratches. So I mean, you still keep that in mind that like batters can get scratched late. And so you have to be still watching the news for that, watching, you know, on our Slack channel, we have the MLB lineup alerts, and that'll show like if someone's scratched, but it's not as common as NBA. And so you're safer building earlier. But you know, you just want to watch out for the starting lineups. I think it can be a mistake to build really early in the morning.
Yeah.
And then you kind of have this bias where you're like, okay, this is the team that I want to play. And then say their lineup comes out and like a key player is missing, that really changes how viable they are as a stack. But you might be kind of locked into this mindset of, I want to play this team. And so that can sort of bias your approach. So, you know, I think just from like a cognitive bias standpoint, you don't want to do it too early, because you don't want to let yourself get locked into these, what you think are the best plays, when things can change later on.
Gotcha. Real quick on the news breaking after lock, you mentioned that it's less frequent than NBA. In terms of impact, what is the impact on a slate if we get a surprise lineup from the Dodgers an hour after lock?
Yeah, it really depends. I mean, obviously, it depends on how viable of a stack they were. You know, if you didn't have any of them to begin with, then it probably isn't going to make a big difference. But, you know, we might get a situation where even if all the players are as expected, the person that you thought was batting ninth is actually batting leadoff, and they're min priced, and suddenly they become a really good play. And so even if like, okay, I don't have anyone out, the lineup, all the players are the same, but like this player's projection just went up a bunch, and so you might want to late swap just for that reason. But if it's something like, oh, they're swapping the 3 and 4 batters, like that doesn't really matter. You don't necessarily need to like redo your whole build for that. So it really is kind of just a judgment call there in terms of, you know, what's changing, how much of this, if you have really high exposure to one of those West Coast games and their lineup changes, then you probably want to rebuild your lineups, because like just doing a quick swap or something of just like replacing one guy with another is going to just, the construction of it isn't necessarily going to be optimized. So it's hard to just give a definite answer there, because there's, it really just depends. On a small slate, it probably matters a lot more than on a giant slate where they're just one of 30 teams. If it's like a four game slate, then you probably want to rebuild for, you know, news like that. So
gotcha.
Yeah.
Cool. So, I mean, thinking kind of back to pre-lock here before you're actually sitting down to build, what does your research process look like? Are you diving into anything in particular to familiarize yourself with the slate, or to strategize to figure out what the best approach is for that particular slate?
No, is the simple answer. I'm really not doing too much research on the slate. I do think that there is valuable research that you can do for baseball. Mm-hmm. But it's, you just have to be really careful with what you're looking at. Like looking at Vegas totals is not really going to be, that's like a popular thing to look at, but like our game totals are going to be pretty similar to those. We're kind of already like baking a lot of those factors in. So that kind of thing I would look at. I wouldn't like do a bunch of builds early in the morning and kind of look at like, okay, here's like what the slate looks like, but how am I going to make these decisions? Mm-hmm. I think one of like, in terms of just researching stuff, I think looking at like pitchers can be a valuable thing to like add to your projection, whether you're using Saber Sim projections or something else, where there's a lot of nuances with pitchers that, especially early in the season, where say like some pitcher added a new pitch over the offseason or over spring training, and maybe they're getting way different results in the first few games, and that's the kind of thing that can be you know, we try to incorporate that kind of thing into the model, but we're not looking at every single pitch the pitcher's throwing and like all of these different factors that are really hard to and most, you know, I don't think any projection system's really doing that perfectly. And so that's the kind of thing that you can research, and if I'll have time, sometimes I'll look at stuff like that where look at a pitcher where say they have just way better results the past few games than they did in previous seasons. I might look into their stats, see like, oh, they're throwing their slider 50% of the time compared to 5% last year, and it's like doing really well as a pitch. Maybe like projections are kind of underrating them a bit. So like that's the kind of thing I might research. But honestly, I don't do too much of that either, because I just don't have the time, and I trust the Saber Sim model and the Sims and the projections. I would say like the most work that I do is sort of in tinkering with my exposures and adding like diversification and risk management. I think that's like, and then sort of those game theory decisions that I mentioned earlier, where I'll run my build without too many changes, but then in like step three, and when I'm adjusting exposures, I'm kind of looking at, okay, my default build is 70% exposure to the stack. They might be kind of chalky, and I want to take some stands in terms of like either going underweight on them or just like maybe matching the field and trying to spread out my exposures a bit more, so that because I think that I have edge in my lineup construction, and so I don't want to go too crazy maybe with my stack choices. I really want to just lean into the edge that I'm getting from my lineup construction, or I want to take stands in ownership and saying I want to really like fade this top owned team and have more exposure to this lower owned team that seems like it has upside, where I'm getting a decent amount of them in builds, and I want to like kind of lean into that more. So that's like the value that I, in my personal process, that's most of the work that I'm doing is in adjusting min and max exposures to primarily stacks, pitchers as well, but generally I'll do less with pitchers than I do with stacks.
Gotcha. That was a really interesting point you just said, of if you have the sense that there's a like an ownership inefficiency, that you'll push that a little harder. But if there isn't as much of that. Maybe you'll lean on just having the right constructions for that particular slate. Did I understand that correctly? How do you get a sense of if you think there is an ownership inefficiency on the slate? What would lead you to think that, like, I mean, is it just like kind of researching ownership projections, or what do you do to determine, hey, I actually think the field's really off here?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it is, you know, I'll look at my exposures. I'll do, you know, on SaberSim, I'll do like the kind of research build and look at like how much are these teams coming up in, you know, in my entire lineup pool. And that's to get a sense of like the probability of a team being like a top stack.
Yeah.
And then I'm kind of comparing that to ownership projections. And, you know, if you, so if you don't kind of make those decisions, then you'll by default just be a bit higher on those like low owned. So say there's a team that's projected to be in 5% of the field, like 5% ownership, like as a stack, and you have 10% of them, you could stick with that and know, okay, I'm overweight on them. But for me, I sometimes like to lean in a bit more and take bigger stands, especially if it's like, if it's a stack that I feel is lower risk, I would say. So, you know, you might have a stack that's like going against, you know, Jacob deGrom, and maybe they're like technically under owned. Maybe they're going to be 1% owned by the field, and actually they should be 2%, but it's still like they have such a low probability of hitting that I don't want to spend too much of my exposure on that low probability outcome. But if it's sort of like a mid-tier stack where I feel like there's just a lot of inefficiency just based on comparing the ownership projections to my like research build, then I might want to like go really heavy on them and make them my top stack, where it's like maybe it's the fifth best stack on use based on like projections in my build, but it's the 10th highest owned stack, and I want to make them just like my top stack because I feel like the difference between it is worth like really taking a stand on that team. But if I'm like running my research build and I see like basically it's sort of the same, like the probability of these teams being the top scoring are like the same as their ownership, then, you know, I might realize, okay, there's less edge there. So I might just more lean into the lineup construction edge. Maybe I'll like do more like weird stuff with my stack types where I might, you know, say like it's Coors and the Rockies are the top projected owned.
Yeah.
You know, my projections, SaberSim also says that they're the top lineup by a lot and they, you know, I want to have a lot of them. Then I'll be like, okay, well, why don't I do like more four stacks of the Rockies than five stacks on DraftKings? I mean, I play just FanDuel because I'm in Oregon. So maybe I'll do like three stacks of the Rockies, or I'll force in more of the bottom of the order guys so that I'm getting more of those 7, 8, 9 hitters that are going to be lower owned by the field. And then maybe I make more ownership decisions on pitching as well. So maybe if I'm going to be, you know, really heavy on the chalky stack, then I'll be a little bit more contrarian in pitching and kind of make myself more contrarian there. So I think for baseball, you really, the important thing is not necessarily to just fade all of the chalk, but you want to differentiate somewhere. So playing the top two owned pitchers with the top two owned stacks is like, you're just not gonna, it's very unlikely that you're gonna like have a winning lineup from like a ownership game theory perspective with that approach. So you want to just differentiate in some aspect of your play. Usually I think it comes from stacks just because I think there's more variance and there's more inefficiencies in ownership there, but it can come from pitching or lineup construction also.
Right. Gotcha. It sounds very similar to kind of my approach here. So, I mean, you would say probably a lot of the research in terms of like, how am I going to tackle this slate? What am I going to do? Comes from building lineups on SaberSim, seeing how things are looking, seeing where ownership's going, and then figuring out on that particular slate, like what tool are you going to pull out from your toolbox? You know, do you want to vary your constructions or, I don't know, you know, get contrarian in this particular way or that particular way?
Yeah.
Cool. One thing, Brad had actually just asked a question. He took the words out of my mouth. I wanted to touch on this when we were talking about research. Definitely something that probably makes sense to at least keep an eye on and very unique, I think, to baseball is weather. What are you keeping track of as it relates to weather throughout the day? And in a situation where there are weather concerns with a game, what's your approach to handling that?
Oh, that's a good question. And one of the toughest parts about base MLB DFS for sure. Yeah. So like if you're new to MLB DFS, keep in mind, most parks are outdoors. it rains in really, I mean, all times of the season, but I think especially in like the spring and fall. Mm-hmm. But I mean, in summer, there can be these like big thunderstorms in the Midwest. But yeah, so you have to look at weather. Mm-hmm. So like I'll look at like the RotoGrinders weather page is a pretty solid resource that Kevin Roth puts out. But there's like a lot of weather resources on Twitter and just like Google kind of MLB DFS weather. And there's like a bunch of different resources where you can kind of get an idea of, you know, just what the weather is like in different parts and like a general sense of the probability that a game is going to be impacted. So obviously the biggest risk is postponements.
Mm-hmm.
So, if you know, if it's raining super hard or there's thunderstorms, a game can get canceled. And like if the game gets canceled, the players get 0 points and you can't do anything about it. And any lineups with those players are dead.
Yep.
It doesn't happen. Honestly, postponements that happen after lock or after the game starts aren't that common. Like there are definitely a handful of them over the year, you know, over the season, but like more frequently, I would say they'll happen like right before lock or something, or like, or maybe like in the hour before lock. So you kind of want to just keep that in mind as you're building, like a game might get postponed 30 minutes before lock and you got to redo everything. In terms of those games where it's like there's a chance that it's going to get postponed or delayed, but you're not sure, I think it's a good idea to just really limit exposure. And I think this is something that I haven't done well in the past, to be honest. I think I've gone too hard on games with weather issues because I feel like, oh, it'll probably be fine. Like maybe I'll get some like ownership edge by playing these players. But I think in general, the field doesn't care about weather that much. Yeah. Like ownership is not impacted as much as maybe it should be by uncertain games. And it's a huge impact. If, you know, say if you knew ahead of time that there's a 50% chance that your pitcher is going to get 0 points, then like you would really limit their ownership. And that's sort of like with weather, that's what's, even though their projection isn't indicating that, like just treat it like there's some percentage chance that your players are going to score zero and that you're adding that to their distribution. And think about it that way and think about, okay, if I knew this was the case, how am I going to limit their, how am I going to like make exposure decisions accordingly? And obviously that doesn't change their upside. And so you might still want exposure to those types of players that are in dangerous weather games, because like, yeah, even if there's a 50% chance they get canceled, there's also a 50% chance that they don't, mm-hmm. but then it's still like you're limiting. So when you only care about upside, instead of there being a 2% chance that they hit their ceiling game, now there's a 1% chance because you have the 50% chance cancellation. So long story short, limit exposure to players, to pitchers and stacks that are in dangerous weather games, but like just keep an eye on sort of experts, meteorologists, whatever, that's, it might look like there's rain, but experts are saying, hey, this is going to pass through. There's actually pretty low impact on the game. Maybe it'll get delayed for an hour and then it'll play, but it's just always a risk because you don't know how teams and parks are going to respond, where it looks like a storm is just going to pass through and then the team's like, we're just going to cancel. And so those are really frustrating situations where sometimes teams just make stupid decisions, and you know, and even if they're stupid, it has the same impact on you where, you know, then you're kind of screwed. So I think it's smart to be just conservative there.
I agree. And I think you made a really good point too of, the ownership never does what you expect it to do. If you're out there and you're like, well, this game's going to be rainy or stormy and it's a great hitting environment and I think everybody's going to get off of it, they're not going to. I remember last year there was a game in Camden Yards with the Astros were in town with like a 7-run total, and the sky before the game started looked like it was going to fall. Like it was like the apocalypse. And there was like a 70% chance for this game to get rained. And then the slate locks, all the cards get flipped over and all the Astros hitters are like 45% owned. Like nobody cares. Everybody's more to play those guys, but okay, cool. This has gone super quick here. Getting close to the end, gone pretty fast. So what we're going to do here, I'm going to quickly go through, we'll do a kind of a, power through these questions real quickly here. So, Let me go ahead real quickly. I guess before we do that, I will mention that today we wanted to do kind of a brief introduction to baseball DFS strategy, higher level strategy. Matt will be coming back on here again tomorrow, joined with Will, to do more of a deep dive into our sims, into our model, everything that's going on there with the actual simulations. And I'll be doing more content next week that is a little bit more of a tutorial, so kind of a strategy guide of putting this all into practice and actually building some lineups on SaberSim. So I know this show has gone pretty quick today. It's not your last shot to get up to speed, to ask questions before the start of the season. But a couple quick questions here I saw come in from Scorpion, I think kind of back on the ownership question. He said, what do you think about the strategy of just always fading the top two stacks?
I think that's probably a bit too, there's not enough nuance there. I mean, if you do that every slate in the season, I mean, you might end up successful there. I think it's like not the worst thing you can do, but it's just like too simple. Like, you can have more nuance there and you can be underweight on the top stacks, or you can play the top stacks when they're like, it is possible for the chalkiest stack on the slate to be under-owned. I do want to point that out. Like, just because a team is the highest owned doesn't mean that they're too high owned, because sometimes they should be. Like, maybe the field is actually like underrating the probability that they're going to be the top scoring. I would say that doesn't happen too often because of just, I think ownership is usually pretty inefficient with those top stacks, but it does happen. And I think you don't have to fade completely too. You can be underweight on a stack so that you can have exposure to them and have lineups that have that stack but differentiate in other spots without completely having no ownership, where, you know, if you're playing 150 lineups and you have no ownership in the top two stacks, then there's a decent chance that you just go, you don't catch anything. And, you know, if you're playing conservative bankroll, that's fine. And you'll have more, you might have more upside in having these really huge nights. But remember that, like, baseball is a long season and you kind of need to grind it a little bit. And I think the best way to make sure you don't go broke is either play a very, very small amounts of your bankroll, which that is an option, or like be a little bit more conservative with your risk management and maybe be underweight on top stacks without fading them completely. I think that's just kind of a smarter way of going about baseball. And I can say, as someone who's played MLB DFS for many years, it's very easy to have long losing streaks because it's such a high variance sport, especially if you're playing a contrarian style of play, and you just have to be really careful about doing that kind of strategy.
Gotcha. This question comes in written in different ways to me on office hours every so often, but would you say that baseball is the strongest sport using SaberSim, or what are your thoughts there?
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, it was the first sport that we had, is, you know, how SaberSim started, and so I think in that sense, like, it is definitely one of the strongest sports. It's hard to say because we've been adding so many sports lately,
right,
especially ones that don't have very high quality competition, you know, that, you know, F1, we're like the only one. So maybe that would probably be our strongest sport because we are the only site that's doing F1 projections. So like relative to the field, but yeah, I mean, baseball is a very strong sport for SaberSim. We've had really good results with it over the years. So I feel like this happened last time. My headphones are gonna run out of battery, maybe. But I'll just continue with this. Yeah, I mean, I think baseball is really strong. I would say like it's on par with like NBA in terms of the strength. Just keep in mind that baseball is so much higher variance that even if we're really strong, you're gonna have losing streaks and we're gonna like miss a lot. But everyone's going to miss a lot because it's impossible to really predict baseball unless it's over a long sample size.
Gotcha. Cool. Let's see. There was one question that I had wanted to make sure that we had gotten here was from Ruben. And he said, does our sim account for how teams like the Red Sox steal signs? Any comment on that?
We don't have a stolen sign factor. I think Ruben and I are both Yankees fans, so I feel like this is the leading question. I mean, to be serious, yeah. You know, we do, if a team benefits from something like that, obviously we don't have a factor that's like, oh, they're stealing signs, but it'll show up in the results and mm-hmm. that's going to be factored into their projections. And we are actually, I mean, we'll get into this in the models call, but we are adding some more, some cool factors in this upcoming season for like yeah. Who the catcher is and stuff like that, where that's going to be sort of impacting like the performance of all the players. And, you know, that's the kind of thing that's, there are ways to account for, I mean, not stolen signs necessarily, but just like different things that the teams do, different ways, like the catcher might be giving signs and stuff like that. So yeah, but no, we have not specifically implemented a stolen sign factor.
Gotcha. Cool. Yeah, I do see there are still a few questions that are in YouTube chat here. I think there's a lot that are going to be very useful in tomorrow's stream when we're really breaking down the simulations in detail. So I'm going to save a few of these for then. For now, Matt, if there was one thing, somebody maybe that played NBA all season or is mm-hmm. just kind of new to baseball, if you wanted to leave somebody with one thought, one thing maybe to focus on or key in on as they get started with their baseball DFS season, what would that be?
Oh, one thing. I mean, we mentioned earlier, but make sure you're stacking mm-hmm. and make sure you are conservative with your stack exposures. So I would say, like, if you've never played baseball before, like the very simple rules of thumb are like, do four or five stacks for your lineups and spread out your team exposures so that you have exposure to a bunch of different teams. You don't necessarily need to do that for pitching. But like, that's kind of like the basics of like getting started, is like stack and don't go too hard on individual like teams, because there's just a high likelihood that they won't do well. But, you know, other than that, I think, you know, if you're using SaberSim like I am, I think it like a lot of that stuff is done for you. But, you know, I think that's really the main thing. If you're getting started, there's obviously a lot of nuance and you can really get strategic and more advanced with what you're doing. But that's how I would start.
Gotcha. Cool. Those were my takeaways as well. Build correlated lineups. It's a high correlation sport, I would say. Yeah. Approach with caution, with chalk, with heavily yep. stacks and even pitchers. It's a higher variance yep. sport. They're not going to be as safe of plays in something like NBA. And yep. I would say the last one I think too is, and you mentioned it, is to diversify, spread out your exposures a little bit more. I think, you know, in NBA, 100% exposure to that elite value play makes a lot of sense. In baseball, 2x the field is probably plenty already of mm-hmm. On the field in those particular plays. So you mentioned it, our approach, I know this video was mostly here kind of higher level strategy, but our approach to building winning DFS lineups at SaberSim is quite a bit different because of our powerful simulations that are powering everything behind the scenes. Matt's going to be back on here tomorrow talking in a little bit more detail about what goes into our sims. But if you're interested in getting a head start, checking us out, seeing what makes us different, come check out our free 7-day trial at sabersim.com. Again, we will be right back on here tomorrow talking about those sims. I'll be doing some more baseball videos next week as we lead up to opening day. But for now, we'll leave it there. So thanks a bunch for coming back on, Matt. That flew by. That was a lot of fun and good luck. Yeah.
Thanks, Jordan. I'll talk to you tomorrow.